This week's guest describes himself as a happiness engineer. He's on a mission to make 1 million people happier. He's done 3 TED Talks. In fact, this is the 3rd time we've recorded this, but that's our errors, not his. We bring you the amazing Jim Pooley. Hey, look, Pooley, first of all, thank you very, very much for joining us and also for joining us for a second time, because yeah. I think we need to, well, third, in fact, but we won't go into that. We need to be honest with people and say, look, hands up, this is us. We're finding our way along and we're sort of learning about this as we do it. But the messages are so important and the passion that we experience is so fantastic that, you know, we just want to get this right. So thank you very much for coming on board. In my normal style, I'm going to pass it over to Jasmine because I know you and have known you for a while now. I'm honored to know you. But I think it's good to get the questions from a different perspective. So with that in mind, over to you, Jas.
Thank you, Jason. And we are so delighted to selfishly have you back so we can listen to you again. As Jason said, for a third time, lucky us. That's very greedy of us. So I promise this will be the last time that we steal you away to hear your words of wisdom. We do know who you are because we've actually spoken to you before. However, mm-hmm. our listeners do not. So please, could you tell us who you are, what you do, and why you do it?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Jasmine. And Jason, thanks for having me back. I'm Jim Pooleyopoulos, but everybody calls me Pooley. It's a nickname that I got many, many years ago, and it's something that has stuck, and actually, I prefer it. I'm hopefully at some point going to join the One Name Club, where people like Oprah and Sting and Pooley all in one name. I am Pooley. I tell people these days that I am a recovering engineer. I have 2 engineering degrees and learned early on in life that I didn't really enjoy doing that kind of work on a daily basis. And so I switched into some other career paths, including sales, marketing, product management, and then eventually landed in a role that I love, which is a professor at a university, a business university. I teach sales and marketing courses there. But recently, in the last, I'd say 5 or 6 years, I think my interest has turned even more inward. And now I am referring to myself more as a happiness engineer. I'm taking what I know about solving problems and I'm trying to apply it to the broader world to help people become happier, more satisfied in their careers and in their personal lives. And also, I'm trying to find a way for people to survive this pandemic that we're going through and improve their mental well-being. You know, who I am is a person who is interested in positive psychology, self-taught in many ways, written a book, co-authored a book with Andy Cope and Sanjeev Sandhu called How to Be a Well-Being, and it's 22 Rules on How to Have Your Best Life. My mission in life, which only recently became clear to me in terms of getting it down to one sentence, is my mission is to make 1 million people happier. I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to measure that, but it's a starting point. And my goal is to leave everyone that I meet with a little bit happier than before and give them the tools to be happier. It's been an interesting journey, and it's part of that journey has landed me here with the 2 of you.
And we are so glad that it has. It's nice to hear that you're starting with a nice low goal of 1 million people to make happier. Nice to hear that. Wow, I need to rethink my objectives there, my life goals.
You got to set something, you know, what do they say? Shoot for the stars.
Exactly.
You have to land on the moon or something to that effect. You know, it's funny. It took me a long time to really codify it like that. And it only sort of came blurting out of me when I was doing a workshop, a happiness workshop for a client. And at the end of it, they were interviewing me and they said, well, you know, why do you do what you do? And I know that's part of this question as well. And what I said was that my mission was to make 1 million people happier. And I said, the reason I'm doing it, so I guess this is the reason also that, you know, to answer your question, the reason that I do it is that I spent 3 decades trying to get to a point where I'm ridiculously happy with my career and my life and my happiness level. I think I do this because I want to send a message to my younger self about the things that I could have done differently, you know, in terms of moving forward with career and happiness and well-being. I feel that those are lessons that anyone can use, whether you're just graduating university or you're in a midlife career crisis or you are on the verge of retiring and don't know what to do with your time. So, you know, the reason I do it is because I want people to realize no matter when they start, they can still arrive at a level of happiness and satisfaction that maybe they've missed out on. And that's kind of what drives me.
I think that's so powerful. That's so powerful because a lot of people feel they need to be at a certain place to then start feeling happiness. And I think it's really important to think it can happen at any particular point. It's just a choice, right? And yeah. Out of all of the wisdom that you have accumulated over the past few years, what would you say is your one tip for life you could give people?
It's so clear to me what it is. And if you'd ask my children, they would, you know, I have three adult children that have found purpose and passion in their careers early, a lot earlier than I did. They would tell you that what I told them from a very young age is the following. Life is about the stories you can tell. That's it. That's my number one tip. And you can unpack that a little bit, because basically what I'm saying is when you're faced with a decision in life, you need to understand which path is going to give me, in my opinion, which path is going to give me the better story to tell later on. And the better story usually comes from the decision that's not the linear progression. The better story usually comes from taking a risk or trying something new that you're interested in, but not quite sure you're going to be able to do it well. Or turning left when you think you should turn right, speaking to a stranger that just is intriguing to you. All these things that we sometimes avoid are the things that really make your life full. And so if I bring it down again to one sentence, I say that, you know, life is about the stories you can tell, because it's all about the decisions in the moment that you make about who you spend time with, what your career path looks like, what sort of things do you learn? What do you sort of immerse yourself in terms of what you learn? You know, the types of books you read and all of the things that lead. Think back on any point in your life, no matter where you are, you've made conscious decisions to arrive at this current moment. So if you're unsatisfied with your career, if you're unsatisfied with your relationships, if you're unsatisfied with, you know, what you're studying or what you're learning or your day-to-day existence, you made these decisions. Now, they might have been heavily influenced by external forces, and that's another thing to talk about, but you made the decision to go one way or the other, which means you can make a decision to change your path. The corollary or the sort of secondary statement behind life is about the stories you can tell, which I think is the other side of the coin here, is that regrets are the echoes of the stories you cannot tell. When you look back and think, man, I regret not doing that, or I regret not speaking to that person, or I regret not making that change in my life, it's all about the things you didn't do. And it's sort of the echoes in your mind of what could have been. And I think that's such a powerful thing, because I know when I look back on my life, there have been moments where some major regrets when I look back and I realize what I would have done differently given a second chance. But the good news is you always get a second chance. There's always a second time to make a different decision. If you just recall regret from the first time, you'll probably make a better decision the second time. Those two things together, I think, really sum up my philosophy. Life is about the stories you can tell. Regrets are the echoes of the stories you cannot tell. And there it is.
I think that's amazing. And I think so many of us can take heed of that in whichever way they feel they should in their life. The one question I would say for that is, of course, it sounds wonderful to, you know, live your life thinking that it's going to turn into a beautiful story. And I completely agree with you. Speak to strangers, go and put yourself into situations you usually wouldn't. And from having conversations with unlike-minded people, you expand your mind. You expand your mind, your body, your soul, everything, just by speaking to people that are not similar to you in the same way as you would by putting yourself out there into experiences that you wouldn't usually experience. What would you say for people, though, that are, you know, limited by the fear, you know what I'm going to say, limited by the fear of not having security, notably financially? For a lot of us, it's really safe to just get the day job and to go in a few hours a week, and not a few hours, but, you know, 9 to 5. And to do that, you need to pay bills. We've all got bills to pay, right? So what's your opinion on that? How do you encourage people to tell these great stories and yet still be secure? Yep.
This is a great question. So a couple things come to mind. If you're younger and you've just starting your career, for example, one of the pieces of advice, again, that I've shared with my own adult children, see, 27, 25, and 23 years old. So they're, you know, early in their careers. And one of the reasons I think they found careers that they love is because I emphasized to them as they were growing up that they need to wrap their lifestyle around their career. And what I see the mistake that lots of young people make is that they wrap their career around their lifestyle. What that means is, if I decide I'm going to graduate from university, and in the United States, I'm not sure how it's structured in the UK, but you could graduate with some serious student loan debt, right? So there's that's a crisis in some ways. If I graduate and decide that I'm going to have a brand new car and I'm going to live in a very expensive apartment, I'm going to go out and eat five nights a week and go out every weekend night, you know, spend money on material things, then I need to find a career that can support that lifestyle. But the problem is that career might not support my soul. If you take it in the reverse way and say, look, this is the kind of work I want to do, and I know what that work generates in terms of income, generally speaking, so I will budget myself very carefully and make sure that whatever lifestyle I pick, what kind of car I drive, where I live, how much I spend on a monthly basis, fits that career, so that I'm not constantly worrying about trying to make more money or cut costs, but I can focus more on mastering the skills of that career. I think that in the beginning, again, if you start with a lot of debt, or if you have to generate a lot more income, you have to make some concessions and say, okay, maybe I do take a career that only pays well, because I have debt and I have things I have to take care of, and eventually family costs and so forth. But even in that situation, what I tell people is two things. One, every job you take should be viewed as an experiment, not an endpoint, and use it as a way to discover what you enjoy doing and what you're good at. And those two things might not be the same. You may enjoy something that's different than what you are talented at doing. And just slowly kind of keep track of those things. And so every time you make a move to a different job, a different role, whether it be a different company or the same company, you try to get a little closer to the things that you really enjoy being good at, and for which you think you can develop more skill, and get away from the things that you just don't like doing, even if you do them well. If you combine the sort of the lifestyle wrapping around the career and the notion or the mindset that every job is an experiment, not an endpoint, then over time, and none of this happens overnight, I think over time you get to a point where you have both. You have mastered a set of skills that you are really talented at delivering because you enjoy it so much. And as a result, you're probably in a position where you're making a decent living because you're in a role that you're being paid well to do because you have mastered it and you are one of the best at doing it in whatever peer group you happen to be working in. And I think older workers have a bit more of a struggle because they've got mortgages and car payments and college costs and, you know, helping their adult children get off the ground. There's so much more. But even in that case, I think that there's an opportunity to just try experimenting with something to learn more about yourself. And then again, make that next career choice something that's a little closer to what you enjoy doing and for which you're willing to spend time to. And honestly, I am an experiment of one, because this is how it all came to me, which was I spent over three decades in jobs that I didn't love, but paid me well, but not enough that I could just walk away from working. And these days I work harder than I've ever worked before, but there are elements of what I do, my happiness speaking, my writing, the workshops I deliver. These are the things I'm passionate about, my teaching. And some of the other things I do because I need to generate a certain amount of income just to pay the bills. I look at that as that's my current ratio. Over time, I'd like to do more of the things I'm passionate about, and I will.
I think you've touched upon something so important here, which is the fact that we're valuing the wrong thing. You know, yes. We're valuing what sustains our bills and what sustains our pocket over what sustains our soul. Mm. And if people were just to see that shift and think, okay, every day is a pursuit of fulfilling their soul, and in doing that, they become the best version of themselves. They're better to people around them, they're better to themselves, and they're more contributing to society because they're contributing to their purpose and why they're here. And I like what you said about take every job as an experiment to discover more about yourself. You know, that's a wonderful way to see your career, because I think it can be so daunting to people, you know, especially young people enter a career and they think, oh God, I've now got to just spend the next year filing papers, and then the following year maybe I'll move on to the T's and the bins, and you know, I started off, I literally would send emails to people going, hi, I'm Jasmine and I'll take out your bins. People loved it, they thought it was hysterical, because I never took myself seriously. And you know, I started making the T's and slowly you start doing more. But you see life as an experience, a way to gain experience. I think it's that mind shift that really helps people, and we see what sustains our soul over what just sustains our pocket ultimately. Right. And that takes us nicely onto the next question. So we've got a mystery question for you from our previous guest, which is, what is the best thing you've ever done that you've not paid for?
So this is such a great question, right? Because you know, as you ask it, I'm thinking to myself, there's so many ways to go about tackling this question, right? You know, I think about things for family and friends and so forth. I'm going to say that doing things for, you know, your family, for example, as a father and as a husband and a son, I'm going to put those aside because those just seem like the things you have to do. But a lot of them are great things that you've done for people. But the one thing I've learned from regret, and this kind of ties into the answer to this question, is many years ago, I had the opportunity to visit my uncle Lazarus. This was in 1989. He was in Greece. And I talk about this in one of my TED Talks, but we made this incredible connection. He was much older than my father, and we made this connection, Uncle Lazarus and I, with very similar personalities, very happy man. Spent a great week together on vacation. And then I left, and I promised I would come back and visit more often. I had only seen him a couple times in my life, but this was 1989. I hadn't been married yet. I was just starting my career. And I talked to him on the phone a few times over the next few years, but I always thought, you know, I should go back to Greece, and I should visit Uncle Lazarus. You know, he's older, and I don't want to regret not going back. Well, then I got married, had kids, got busy with work. 22 years passed, and Uncle Lazarus passed away with me never visiting him again. When my father called me to tell me about that, there was this gut punch. You know, there was sadness and mourning, but there was shame. I felt shame at having made that promise and not doing it and not following through on it, because I felt like I missed out on lots of stories I could tell if I had gone back to visit him again and again and again, even seen him two or three more times, right? Getting to Greece to see him. So that kind of informed me in terms of the idea that regrets are the echoes of the stories you cannot tell, because there were so many great stories that I knew that I could have learned from him. A few years ago now, probably 3 or 4 years ago, I heard that my favorite teacher from my middle school years was very ill and was probably terminal. And I hadn't spoken to Mrs. J, that was her nickname, over 30 years. I mean, I had seen her a few times after graduating from high school, but I hadn't seen her in a very long time. And I just heard through the grapevine that she was very ill and that her sons, you know, were saying, if you've ever thought about, you know, dropping her a line, sending her a card, this would be a great time to do it because she's struggling with cancer and, you know, we don't know how much longer she'll be able to fight. So one afternoon I decided she was in a hospital, you know, about an hour away from my home. I got in my car, I drove to the hospital. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell her. I didn't tell her sons. I just showed up at her hospital door, and I walked in, I knocked on the door, and I said, "Hi, Mrs. J, do you remember me?" And she looked at me and she said, "I do," you know, and she kind of squinted and she said, "You're Jimmy Pouliopoulos's father." And I said, "Well, actually, I am Jimmy Pouliopoulos, but my father and I are both bald men now, and you're remembering him when he was my father when I was your student." And we spent 2.5 hours just catching up and speaking. She moved to a different facility, and I went and visited her there a few more times. And we just talked. She passed away a few months after that. So I reconnected with her and spent maybe a year with just conversations. I went to her funeral and her sons took me aside, and they couldn't have been nicer or more complimentary about what a difference I had made in her life, especially at the end. That, you know, that she had so many students and so few, you know, came back. And they said she would talk about you all the time after you kind of revisited. And it made me feel great that I could have helped her at the end like that. But I also tell people, you know, I learned to do that, and I tried to avoid having that same regret of what happened with Uncle Lazarus. And so anytime you have a regret in the past, you can learn about how to do things differently going forward. And that's certainly one of the lessons here. But frankly, the best thing about doing something like that, you know, quote unquote, for free, good as I think made Mrs. J feel, man, it made me feel even better. It's very selfish. It's strategic selfishness to do something like this for somebody else because they feel great and you know that and you're doing it for them. But afterwards, you feel so fantastic about yourself. To this day, when I tell the story, as sad as I am that Mrs. J is gone, even as I'm telling the story right now, I can't help but smile and think about 6 or 8 months or, you know, however long it was that I was visiting her and catching up with her and genuinely telling her that she was one of the people that I consider a role model when I teach these days. It was great. And it was for free and no one asked me and I didn't tell anyone I was doing it. I talk about it now because it's such an informative lesson in terms of taking what you regret and turning it into something positive the next time you have that same choice to make. I think that comes to mind in terms of that. And I don't know if that quite answers the question, but at least that's the way I view it.
I think it answers the question in the most profound, poignant way that I think a lot of people listening might actually have a few tears shedding because yeah. I think you know it's true. It's those small acts of kindness that really not only help the other person and make them feel loved, but it also enriches you in so many ways as well. So I think that's a wonderful way to answer the question. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
For your question for our next guest, what would your mystery question be for them? And the hard part is, how would you answer it yourself?
Yes, great question. So I knew that I had to come up with a mystery question. So I thought about this a lot. And of course, it's tied to a lot of the themes that I've already discussed, right? So here's the mystery question. What would your 12-year-old self be most disappointed about in your adult self? And what would they be most proud of? Because I think for me, a lot of it is about, what did you wish for when you were younger? What did you actually do when you got older? I know this for me. So if I had to answer this for myself, in other words, what would my 12-year-old self be most disappointed in? I think number one, they'd be disappointed that I never became an astronaut, because that was a thing that I wanted to do. And I never even pursued, you know, a career in the space program, which, again, might have been interesting. And maybe if I did, I would have still been an engineer today. I don't
know.
Never
too late.
Never too late. No, it's never too late. You know, the other funny thing about that, as I look back and I think, did I really want to be an astronaut, or did I just love science fiction so much that sort of seemed like an adventurous type life? I also think that what my 12-year-old self would be most proud of is the fact that certainly like 12 years old, you know, around that time is when I was encountering some of these phenomenal teachers that really subconsciously affected what I ended up doing for a career. So Mrs. J and all the other great teachers I had from that point all the way through high school and into college. The thing that I always remembered was not so much what we were studying, from some of these teachers, how enjoyable it was and how easy it was to learn with them. So I think what my 12-year-old self would be most proud of is that, you know, I've arrived at a point where I am teaching and speaking and doing things in a way that would have made my 12-year-old self incredibly happy in class and inspired. And so I think they'd be proud of the career that I have resonates with me at a very core level, that I'm influencing and impacting lives every time I speak in front of an audience, or every time I speak in a classroom. You know, for me, the best part of my day is when I get an email from a former student or a participant in one of my workshops telling me how I've change their lives. The 12-year-old Pooley would be really fascinated to see the impact that I'm having on people, because I don't think the 12-year-old me ever thought I'd become a professional speaker or author or educator. I think they would be pretty fascinated by the fact that I did, you know, and those are the things these days that I'm most proud of myself in terms of my own, the decisions I've made and sort of my late career switch, you know, in terms of what I'm doing. And I think I also represent someone who had a career that didn't love their career for quite a long time, but has found something later in life that I never think about retiring ever. I will do this until they tell me to stop. It's kind of how I look at it. So yeah, I think that's what my 12-year-old self would feel. They would see that. And I think hopefully they would smile.
I'm sure they would. And I know that I'm very envious of your students. I thought this when we last spoke. I thought, God, I wish I'd been taught by you. And I know Jason thought the same. Yeah. Is there any way that people can access any of the amazing work that you've done? So you've mentioned your book, which is wonderful, and people should definitely go and buy that. It's How to Be a Wellbeing. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's the one, How to Be a Wellbeing. Yeah.
And what else can they access, just to round off, more of your work?
No, thank you. The easiest way is just to go to my website, Pooley.com, Pooli.com. You know, I try to keep that up to date. You can find all of my three TED Talks there. One is about Uncle Lazarus. One is about career satisfaction. I call that one Watermelon Seeds. It's all about the pressure that university and college graduates feel to find the right career. And the last one is called Serious Happiness. And I take the happiness equation and I apply it to my life, and I show people the peaks and valleys of my happiness, explain how they can fix the equation for themselves. So those are my three TED Talks. They're on Pooley.com. I've got a blog there. I've got additional videos on there, things that I've done, and there are links to different podcasts like this one that I've been interviewed on. So that is the central hub of the Pooley universe, is Pooley.com. And the book is How to Be a Wellbeing. The subtitle is Unofficial Rules to Live Every Day, and to really live every day. And it's composed of 22 rules that we think, if you follow them, or most of them, you'll be happier. It's all there, Pooley.com.
And I'd like to think also we can help you get into influencing a million people. We can push the numbers up on that account as well.
Great. I got to have a ticker on my website.